You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear, you're an action figure! You are a child's plaything!
You are a sad, strange little man.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective Series.
Shall we play a game?
No, thank you.
Are you sure?
Join Matt.
Oh, thank goodness you're here!
Adam.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Huh? He's posing.
And Garrett.
Stand still, Godzilla!
As they look at each film of the Toy Story franchise.
Alright, let's review this one more time.
From 1995's beloved original,
let's go home and play.
To 2022's Lightyear and beyond.
Oh, shoot some ladders.
Andy's favorite podcasters will review each Toy Story film and decide individually if the series flies or just falls with style.
Son of the building block!
So get ready to reach for the sky, podcast listeners.
Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me?
Percolated Media's Toy Story Retrospective begins now.
All right, let's go.
Toy Story 2, released November 24th, 1999. So it made it just before Y2K killed everybody. Budget was $90 million, box office take of $511 million, and for the second consecutive week, it was directed by John Lasseter. Well, they may have beaten Y2K, but I guess the technology got the last laugh. You know, the production history of how this movie almost got wiped from the face of existence.
And then redone again. Like, there's a lot to discuss with this one.
Yeah, for a movie that almost wasn't. In so many ways. Well, to the surprise of no one, Toy Story was when they saw the returns, they wanted a sequel right away. Almost right after the movie opened, there were talks about doing another film, but what Disney was doing at this time, in addition to their animated theatrical films, they were starting to get into doing sequels that were direct video at a time where you could do that without having to sign up for a subscription service. Oftentimes, they were pilots for television shows. That's what the Aladdin sequel was. It's essentially the first episode of the show stretched out to two parts. But a lot of their other theatrical films were getting sequels. You had Lion King 2, you had Hunchback of Notre Dame 2, Cinderella 2 and 3. So
Aladdin.
Pixar getting in that headspace did make a certain degree of sense. But they met with Joe Roth, who was the new chairman of Disney, because by this point, Jeffrey Katzenberg had left and went on to start DreamWorks Animation, which is ironic because Ants was their first movie, and it came out head-to-head with Bugs Life.
We should talk about, too, that Bugs Life was also a part of Lasseter's plan right after Toy Story. People were asking, are you going to do Toy Story 2? He's like, nope, I'm doing this other one first. And then that came out and was also a success.
Yeah, and with DreamWorks, I mean, there was the rumors that the way that everything went down with this, Pixar almost got brought into that. You know, they were about to leave the mouse over not even creative differences, but just measuring contests. And, you know, they were going to be done. They weren't going to work with the mouse anymore. And DreamWorks was one of the places looking to acquire them.
And DreamWorks, by this point, when this came out, you already had Ants. You had, I think, Prince of Egypt was about to come out if it hadn't already. So they were starting to get their own animated library, so to speak. But Bugs Life came out, it did well, but it did not garner the critical praise that Toy Story did, which is tough, because how do you follow up a movie that was so much of a landmark in both technology and storytelling? Well, on the cynical side, you could look and say, well, let's go back to the well and do Toy Story 2. But there was a lot of sort of apprehension about doing it from the part of John Lasseter, because he moved on to, like you said, Bugs Life. And when they pitched this to him after they got the green light, there were also a lot of questions as, is Lasseter going to direct it? Can we get the stars to come back? Because by this point, Tom Hanks, when he eventually signed on to this, it was the highest contract someone had ever signed for voice work. It was $15 million he made off of this.
That's not even including residuals, too. Jesus.
No, it was a base salary. Yeah. And Lasseter's pitch was initially, there's a lot of animators at Pixar who could take this on. You had Andrew Stanton and Pete Docter, who were kind of his proteges. Stanton being a co-writer or co-director of Bug's Life, Pete Docter would eventually get Monsters, Inc., which was the film they made after this. And there were a lot of people who were in line. And then they settled on Ash Brannon, who was the animation director on Toy Story. And Lasseter picked him to do this film. And they announced it for a press release in 97. So it was basically right after Bug's Life had come out or was about to come out or was still in production. But sequels, you know, it's the dirty word even back in 1999. And it was also something that even Disney themselves, their animated theatrical catalog, they only did one sequel in their line. And it was The Rescuers mm-hmm. Down Under.
Rescuers Down Under.
Which is better than the original, but also the original Rescuers was not one of their classics in the same breath as Snow White, Cinderella, etc. But the crazy thing is that eventually Lasseter went ahead and they went full swing. And there was also a question, was Pixar even going to produce this thing? Because of Bug's Life, there was a team of 300 people who were working on that film for 1998. You know, the product group had their own animation department. So they were really on a time crunch, not just with Bug's Life, but some of the CD-ROM games that they were making with Toy Story. And between the two of them, it was as much original animation as there was in the feature film when you combine them together. And from there, the switch was made shortly after of, we're going to put this in theaters. Now, the difference between this and Mask of the Phantasm is they gave them a lot more time to get it made, which we talked about that several years ago, that film also was not intended to go to theaters and did seemingly at the flick of a Warner Brothers executive. But by doing so, a lot of production issues started to rear their ugly head. And Disney apparently was unhappy with the pace. Guggenheim, who was one of the producers, Disney requested that he was replaced. So people got promoted. And they started looking at the story reels. And they liked what they were seeing to warrant a theatrical release. Because one of the negatives you can say about the Aladdin sequel, when you go back and watch it, the animation is nowhere near as good. Characters are not as expressive. The colors don't stand out as much. So I could understand the resistance to put something that looks lackluster in theaters, which is ironic considering how a lot of modern Disney films are ugly as sin, right, Adam?
You're not kidding. And the other thing that they had hoped to garner out of it was going to complete their initial contract. Disney kind of wanted to be done with Pixar and vice versa. So by going to theaters as opposed to going to video, we did a 3-picture theatrical deal. We were going to be done. Disney wasn't going to have to finance their next one, and they could all move off to greener pastures.
Yeah, it was a 3-picture deal initially. And then there, when they started to negotiate with Steve Jobs and Roth, what they settled on was they were going to split the costs equally between Disney and Pixar and the profits. And from there, it would follow a 5-film deal. But Toy Story 2 was not going to be included in that count, which is why their next 5 films were all non-sequels. They were original ideas. I'm sure that was part of the settlement as well, or I shouldn't say settlement, but agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Because Disney also said, we get 5 sets of characters to put in our merchandising and theme parks. So it's all about merchandising, which is ironic because we just got a trailer for Spaceballs 2, which made me laugh. That's all I can think of. And they were working on the movie, and one of the animators accidentally entered the deletion command code. You cannot make this up.
Yeah, they apparently were trying to make an edit on the film, and a stroke of a key, and the entire thing was fucking erased. Completely taken out. And yeah, I would not want to be on that board meeting. I get nervous when I have that happen to these guys when we do a podcast. I could not imagine all the work these animators did. And apparently they were up for 48 hours at a time. They had a set release date and they were working their asses off to do it. And lo and behold, the fucking file gets erased. And this is quite a story. Continue, Matt.
Yeah, so they noticed it because the character models were just disappearing. And anyone who knows animation knows that you have to recycle the same models mm-hmm. and just put them in different backdrops and all that. So they shut down the servers, but they lost, and this is a staggering number when you think about how long these movies take to make, 90% of the work. Basically, mm-hmm. 2 years of progress were gone. Ironically, it was saved, though, to a certain degree, because you had someone who was working remotely because they just had a kid. She had a backup mm-hmm. copy on her computer. So by the grace of God... Yeah, which was kind of a breach of contract, but the only reason they didn't file a litigation suit is because they needed the assets.
Yes.
Like Olympus slide, and you know, they recovered basically everything. They only lost a couple days, which is a sigh of relief compared to losing 2 years. But it gets even crazier because even the stuff they had, a lot of it creatively, people were not excited with what was being done from a story perspective. Mm-hmm. Lasseter himself watched the reels and said, something about this is just not working. And they met with mm-hmm. Disney. Disney said, no, of course it's fine, because I'm sure they were thinking, we have a release date already set, we're not going to move it. And they also said, we don't think you have enough time to basically scrap everything before our release date. But Pixar put their foot down, literally, and said, we just can't release this. And they asked Lasseter to come on and direct, which he, it's not that he had no interest in doing it, but I think he realized, he said in the one of the documentaries, I can't ask someone to do something that I wouldn't be willing to do myself. And look, Lasseter, a lot of personal stuff we could talk about that have reared their ugly heads, but that's commendable from an artistic standpoint.
He'd finished Bug's Life. He was done. He needed a break. He had taken this fledgling studio, changed what it was going to become, had worked on two movies that both, you know, were very highly regarded and really changed animation. He needed a break. He was going away, and he gets a call that's like, we need you, and he's got to stop and go back to work. And not just go back to work, but double down on the amount he was going to have to work mm-hmm. to get this thing fixed. It's, I mean, damn. This is why I think he was pegged to be Bob Iger's successor until he was fired, you know, at this point, what, 6 years ago. I think he was the clear choice that they were going to put in place.
Right. And Stanton and Doctor stayed on as co-directors, and they basically redeveloped the story from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, after all that
work. And they finished
and they have a release date, like, stamped down. Like, they have to make this release date. Unlike the first Toy Story, where there was pressure, but not too much as to follow up one of the most well-regarded movies of all time with the sequel and hit this release date, and you get all that shit lost, and now the higher ups are like, this isn't working, you need to change. I mean, that I could not imagine being in those rooms at that time. And like I mentioned, there were stories coming out where people were so tired they were leaving their kids in their cars for a set of hours while they went in the store and falling asleep behind the wheel. Like, there's a ton of stories like that if you research it. Just crazy that they were able to get all of this together and put together what they did. Even the fact that they got it out is a triumph in my eyes.
Think about the perspective of, you finish a movie after scrapping essentially everything in 9 months.
Yeah, that was the other thing too. These take years to render. Years. They had to get all this together within 9 to 12 months. That is insane, and that's where all the long hours come to play.
Yeah. You had people getting carpal tunnel syndrome, like RSI symptoms. It was a... When we talk about time crunches, this is one of the biggest examples you can find. And part of it's also just with animation. Nowadays, it's a lot easier. I don't think you'd ever see something like this happen again. If it did, heads would literally roll in all likelihood. But I guess you could say, when they got to the finish line, which is miraculous in and of itself, that they made the deadline and all of that stuff, the movie comes out, and not only does it do well because it got families back involved, and I'm sure a lot of people were excited for it, which I didn't ask this at the start. Adam, when this was coming out, you know, you obviously lavished the first film with praise. What was your expectation going into this?
Wasn't sure. I had known the drama behind it, and as much as it's Pixar, you know, it's got Disney's name all over it, Disney didn't do animated sequels, and they sure didn't do animated sequels that I cared about. You know, it was, you know, The Little Mermaid and her sisters. It was, what, The Lion King 1.5. It was that kind of stuff. So I wasn't interested. You know, animated sequels are straight to video. So, okay, you're putting it in theaters for a cash grab. But I had no interest. As much as I love Toy Story, and because we're not going to get over it or get to it, I guess I could say it, I love A Bug's Life even more. That is one of my Pixar top three, top four. I wasn't interested in a sequel. I thought original stories with the way that they were storytelling was the way to go.
Yeah. Did you think this was kind of the... Even though Disney was not the parent company, did you feel like at the time this was Disney kind of putting their nuts on the table?
Oh, yeah. I felt this was a forced, you know, move that they had done. That it was, you're going to do this because we're Disney.
And simple question for you, Garrett. I assume you did not care about this at all.
Yeah, it was all about End of Days coming out that same month.
Of all the movies in 1999, that's the one you pick.
No, you know what? I didn't really care, but I had somebody in my family who did. And that was my brother. This came out Thanksgiving weekend, and I believe me and him went Thanksgiving weekend to see it. And I remember being kind of underwhelmed. You know, I remember just thinking that wasn't as good, as, at least as the first movie, and I'm not sure how much I do like it. And I had also heard all the stories, not everything in detail like we just outlined, but to me, this movie was showing more red flags than A March Through Moscow. Like, I didn't really want any part of it. My brother really wanted to go. We went, and I thought the word that comes to mind is fine. I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was any better than what we saw last week. And then we watched it for our retrospective, Matt, back in 2019. And this time, this would be my third time watching it in total. We'll see if my assertion has changed.
Well, your opinion on it was certainly muted compared to everyone else, because this thing came out, and much like the first one, it's one of the only, it's hard enough to get 100% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes as it is, given the formulas, and but you have two films back to back that have that benchmark, which is, I can't think of another franchise that has that on that website alone. And you had a lot of people saying, you know, this is the one of the sequels that's better than the original, which is the fact that those words were even in the conversation, given the production history, is one of like the biggest surprises you'll find, like I said, given all the issues this thing went through. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's a bigger endorsement than Chuck Jones himself writing a handwritten letter to John Lasseter, just heaving nothing but praise on this movie. And it's got, you know, it's gotten, I don't want to say re-appraised, but it's still held up in pretty high regard and all that type of stuff. But Adam, when you saw it way back in 99, what'd you think?
I didn't see it in 99. This wasn't a theater watch for me. I didn't see it until later. And you know what I did say? I think I saw it once a week for 4 straight weeks was The World Is Not Enough.
Yeah, that's right. That also came out this month.
That came out like 2 weeks before, yeah. 3 weeks before. So this I did not see until, yeah, later. And I, you know, glossed over the theater. Once it hit December, the only thing I cared about was celebrating the new millennium and was Y2K going to destroy my job as a computer tech at the time. So when I did see it, and eventually I regretted that it had taken me a while to see it.
Well, and the crazy thing is in a year that 1999, everybody talks about, it's this landmark crop of films that released, you know, this opened the same weekend as, I believe it opened the same weekend as World Is Not Enough. If not, it was pretty close to your point. Sleepy Hollow was also released around this time. End of Days, to Adam's or to Garrett's enjoyment. You know, I'm the Arnold fan on this podcast, and even I don't especially care for that. But it broke the studio record for the studio being the parent company at the time for having the best single day gross ever, and it broke Back to the Future 2's record for biggest Thanksgiving Day opening weekend. It beat the Lost Worlds number. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tremendous success, which to the surprise of no one, because I think these films have been consistently performing well until you get to 2022, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks. But, you know, we got to talk about whether this thing still holds up, because you've had two films come out since then that have also been pretty high regarded. And in some ways, we'll talk about next week, this one didn't get Oscars in the same way that the first one got nominated, or the third one, which got a Best Picture nomination. But we'll talk about this next week. I think the fact they cropped the field to 10 is one of the reasons why that happened.
Yeah, this did not get the Oscar love. I remember the Golden Globes. I believe it won a Golden Globe, or at least it was nominated for one. But
yeah, I'm sure at Pixar they use those as door holders.
Yeah, the Oscar love did not come this year. And that I remember that being a bit of contention with some people.
Well, especially when you look at, not to go back to past shows, the movies they picked for Best Picture that year in 1999, I'd maybe leave one of them on that list. American Beauty, Cider House Rules, oof, The Insider, Sixth Sense, and I don't even remember what the fifth one was. I would say, Green Mile, which we'll talk about. Actually, we'll be talking about it within the next couple of years. Uh-huh. And this one was ironically, the Sixth Sense made more money than Toy Story 2, which, yep, is crazy. But obviously, the number one that year was Phantom Menace. That blew the doors off everyone. But time to get into the movie. So the movie opens, you get the big Toy Story 2 logo, and we see right away the advances in computer technology with the animation, first and foremost, specifically with Buzz flying through space.
You know what I really liked about this? I know it's going to eventually be revealed to be a video game, but what I like about this is right away we see, last time Buzz was the odd man out, right? He was trying to get integrated. Here we understand he's fully integrated in with the group, and that was kind of nice to see that we have the beginning. Instead of being centered around Woody, it's centered around Buzz.
Agreed. And Matt, to your point, the animation, you know, if you're going to start something and you want to showcase and you want to bring people in with a big, you know, wow, holy heck, the way they animated his helmet and the reflection, it just, Jesus, Ted, things right now, 25 years later, most of them don't look as good as this opening sequence.
Right. And you have the, like, him burning up on reentry, you know, you have to animate that. And if you're wondering, you could also think this is Andy's, like, imagination, which makes the reveal of what it is even funnier.
Yeah, and I think Pixar was like right down the street from Lucasfilm, right, Matt, Adam? Because we have a lot of Star Wars effects here, too. I'm hearing the TIE fighter blaster. I'm hearing Darth Vader's breathing when he's behind the helmet. There's a lot of Star Wars sounds going on here, too, which I don't think was unintentional.
Yeah, at this point, they had the Pixar campus in Emeryville, and they still had some offices in Point Richmond, which is where ILM had their warehouse and work done. So, yeah, at one point, they were really closed, and they hadn't finished, I don't believe at this point, moving everything to the Emeryville, where you have the big sign, gates, and that famous photo.
Yeah, and look, there's going to be a lot of Star Wars in this movie, which
oh yeah,
yeah, not just the sound effects, but you know, you see Buzz crash land on a planet, you see all the Zerg drones, which we only heard about Zerg in the first movie, it's just part of the exposition for the character, but you know, he's got these giant like robots that he fights, you see the laser actually working as a laser,
yes,
because the first one it's just that little light. So
now I don't remember, Matt, did we see Zerg last week or did we just
know he's
him,
only right? He's okay. Only mentioned,
so this is the first time we've actually seen
it. Yeah, and when we get to that model, I love the design they come up with. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly very Darth Vader-esque. I think it's intentional for multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. But they're also doing all the like the cliched things where he, you know, he's sneaking around. You have the giant wall with the spikes coming at him. You know, he goes through the doors at the last minute. It's very kind of action movie cliche. And you get the big reveal of him fighting Zerg, shooting the laser. It's doing nothing. He jumps over him. It gets disintegrated. Which, if you're a kid, you're like, oh my God, what just happened?
That was kind of fun.
The camera pans out. We see it's Rex, of all people, playing a Buzz Lightyear video game with Buzz behind him. And this is even funnier because you got the guy with the short arms trying to use a video game controller.
So great. The way they use Rex in this, I didn't remember this, but he is absolutely phenomenal in this movie. I think he's here just for the Jurassic Park joke they're going to have later, but still, he has some really funny lines, mostly that has to do with those short arms of his.
The way he's written and voice acted is just, it's perfect.
I adore Wallace Shawn as this voice. Just adore him.
Yeah, he's like, I've been stuck on this level for years, which anyone who's played video games knows that level, especially at a time where if you wanted to beat those kind of games, you had to buy strategy guides, which yep. They make fun of in this movie.
Especially Nintendo games, because he's playing a Super Nintendo, if you know your controllers, and Nintendo is notorious for saving. No, you're just going to keep playing the same levels.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like you either have to raise your electricity bill or you try the game again in one shot. So I think this is great. It's also, they're getting a little bit more modern with the technology, although in 1999, we were already on the N64. So you're a generation behind. But I like that they're not doing it too modern because you run the risk of being dated, but you're also doing retro because this movie, in a lot of ways, as we'll find out, it's about nostalgia.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
As a tremendous part of it. But one of the things that this movie also does is you now have Woody and Buzz as co-leaders. They're the best friends. They're all the supporting characters are still here. We've moved a little bit forward in time. I think canonically it's like a year, maybe 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be about that because his sister Bonnie's at least walking and talking.
Well, she's getting ready to walk. She's almost walking by the end of this. Yeah. I think it's only a set of months. I thought it was like maybe 8 or 9 months is what I thought.
I mean, it could be. It's never definitively said, but Andy's clearly older. He's ready to go off to summer camp, which another thing this movie's really known for are the memes because we get the s'mores joke. Can't say that. And Woody's starting to, you know, he's now come to terms with not being the sole alpha male. But if the first one was arguably more Buzz's story, this one, the pendulum has swung the other way. But that's not to say that Buzz isn't an integral part of this.
Oh, he's big time part of this.
We're seeing everyone's pretty harmonious. Andy comes into play. And through the midst of all this, Woody gets a little rip on his arm, which I'm sure for a toy, that's like the kiss of death, which is written to be true based on how he reacts. And of course, Potato Head's the one giving him shit for it because that's in line with the character. And they also pay off the Mrs. Potato Head thing from the last movie.
Yep.
Yes.
Another great piece of just casting for this. Oh, man.
Yeah. All I think of is George's mom. That's all I hear. which makes me wish, like, look, I love Don Rickles, but Jerry Stiller could also have played Potato Head, and it would have been the same thing.
Yep.
But, you know, now Woody realizes that, you know, he's getting older, because if you look at all the other toys, he's from a previous generation. You know, there's no batteries, there's no high-tech stuff. He's got a pull string, which they don't even make those in 1999. So we're already starting to see, you talk about with sequels, you got to put characters in a new, put a new obstacle in front of them. And this one, it's about Woody coming to terms with both middle age and mortality, things that are inanimate objects, which is really existential for a kid's movie.
Big time question. And I don't remember if we talked about this last week, but what is Andy doing with a Woody doll? This is like, what, two generations behind him?
Adam had a theory that it was his father's toy that was passed down.
Yep.
Okay. Because it just doesn't make any sense that this kid would have this pull string cowboy doll when all these video games and all these other toys are at his disposal. It really rubbed me the wrong way this time watching this movie. It was just like, what is Woody doing here? Like, he should have been having this crisis like a decade before.
Well, I think it's also the, like, Andy is now... Now that he's a little bit older, he's not as hyper-fixated on one thing he likes, you know, because you reach that age where you go through phases. You know, Garrett, you've talked about having a He-Man obsession for a while, and I think all of us have had that with a certain brand, but you realize that you have other interests and you're not just having tunnel vision on one particular, you know, because we see that all the other toys still get played with. And one of them is a piggy bank, which is not even technically a toy.
Yeah.
Which I'm grateful with, because Ham gets some of the best stuff in this movie.
Great Ham moments in this.
But even the mom realizes it, because she puts Woody on the shelf, literally, and everyone treats that like it's like you're put in a hospital bed, because that's the sign that you're kind of past your prime and you're not going to be played with as much, which is proven true, because he finds another toy back here, ironically named Wheezy, that they forgot about, you know, because his squeaker doesn't work. And, you know, what good is a cowboy doll with a bum arm?
Bum arm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I also appreciate that you have... a movie that is filled with so many characters, and they add a lot more characters into this, but it never feels, pardon the pun, overstuffed. But I think everyone gets enough to do.
I do too.
And part of it's also, you have the device of, we have to do a rescue mission for a big chunk of the movie, so all the prominent supporting characters get to go. And one thing I also love, and I can't believe I'm saying this, I like nightmare sequences, because in Disney films, they're kind of notorious. Like, you have the pink elephants thing from Winnie the Pooh. It wasn't live action, but you had a Goofy movie with a big hallucination sequence where that's the, you know, Woody's existential crisis of realizing that Andy is not going to play with him anymore. And they do some really cool animation where he falls in the deck of cards and he winds up in the garbage. He's being pulled down by all the rejected toys that look like the ones that Sid played with. I appreciate traumatizing children.
Yeah,
I don't think we get enough of this in modern day kids films.
Yeah, this is trippy. I forgot about this whole nightmare sequence. I am with you, man. I enjoy the sequence quite a bit.
And I like watching it through my kids' eyes, because they were all kind of freaked out by it. I'm just sitting there smiling, because I'm like, this is the lesson you have to learn. It is okay to scare children. I think we take for granted kids like to be scared. And I don't think enough modern movies take these kind of chances. Now, that's not to say that some don't in other aspects, but I appreciate having a little bit more. And this is the thing Pixar, I think, has done really well for so long. They never, or I shouldn't say never, because they made Cars 2. They never talk down to kids. So if we ever do the Cars films, do I have words about that? Hopefully I have Alzheimer's by the time we get to that. But, you know, Woody wakes up, realizes it's all a dream. And if the first film, you had the whole moving crisis, what's another thing for a toy? A yard sale. And they treat that almost to the same degree. They treat all these events like they're preparing for natural disasters in like real life, which I also appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling everyone to stick together. You get the payoff of the previous film, because the dog is used once the mom comes in. She takes Wheezy. She takes some other ones, which is also bad because Andy doesn't really get a say in this. This is the mom sort of taking.
Yeah, the mom is the one that I'd forgotten about. She's the one who grabs Woody and puts him in with the yard sale. Like, did we even know there was going to be a yard sale? Does she even tell Woody that she was going to do this? Or did she just wait till he left for cowboy camp and was like, okay, I'm just going to do this to get rid of these toys?
Yeah, he sees the sign yard sale, and that causes like the whole operation protocol. But Woody thinks he's going to get grabbed, but she takes the Wheezy instead. And I like that we have a movie that's a rescue mission that is largely caused by Woody trying to execute a rescue mission. Yeah. And Woody in this one, you know, he's got a lot of stuff in this movie as far as like a character arc, but he's much more likable in this one than he is in the second one.
Yes.
Or in the first one, which is intentional.
Yes. Woody is more of a hero in this than he was last week. He actually gets a couple really good heroic moments, which I respected. Because last week, he had moments where we all hated him.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, he uses the dog to sneak out. As we'll find out in this movie, the toys have to be very secretive.
Oh, God. Yeah. This drove me nuts. One sequence which, in particular, I'll just say it. There was a moment in this I really hated. Well, if I had problems with last week of them hiding from view, I have even more issues with it this week.
And he winds up on the table, and as we'll find out, Estella Warren's not the only Seinfeld principal actor who's going to show up in this You know, because this movie also has, the first film only has like one principal antagonist, if you want to count Sid as that. This, as we'll find out, has several.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that kicks this movie off is Woody gets grabbed by Al because he's a toy collector, and he's foreshadowed because you see the commercial on the TV earlier for like Al's Toy Barn, so that comes into effect. But I think it's a little convenient in a movie that I think is very well written that he happens to be at this yard sale, given that Woody was not publicized and just happens to find the one piece of the collection he's been searching for all these years. I do find this to be a little too convenient.
God, what kind of asshole collects dolls as an adult, right, Adam?
Dang it. I was like, yeah, the bad part is this was so ahead of its time for 1999. Like, anybody who's gone to any type of garage sale or toy sale or anything else have realized just how despicable adults have become with this. I'll call it hobby. So, yeah, unfortunately, I know some people that are just like Newman here.
Yep.
Or Al.
And he was based off of Lassiter, which you look back and man, what he ended up being revealed as, it's kind of disturbing. But back then, I think it's kind of funny that he was the one who was like, you know what, let's not base this on anyone but me. I'm the one who wears all the fucking short sleeve Hawaiian shirts. We're going to put him in those. I do find it funny that he was the one who came to the forefront and was like, yeah, go ahead, base this slob on me.
Well, remember, this also happened to Brad Bird with Syndrome. That was not the intention to base the look off of him. So I guess you should have taken advice from Lassiter. Wonder if that was part of the discussion when you come to Pixar, you have to know what you're getting into, that you are also going to be a target if the animators don't like you. And he's trying to like talk up the mom, but she's not having it. So he just steals Woody for all intents and purposes. And they try to rescue him, but they're too late and he gets taken.
Yeah, which it's really weird. This all unfolds really bizarrely because she's just like, no, that's a special toy to... And the sleazy asshole is just doing these tricks to make sure that he steals them. It was really bizarre. And again, why wouldn't he come alive and get out of his hands? Like, it's just, ugh.
This is the type of person, and it's funny, my oldest, she sat down and was watching part of this with me, and we're laughing at this. And I go, you know those stories about grown men who show up at Target on the day that Pokemon cards get released and restocked, or that figurines get restocked, or Hot Wheels get restocked, and they grab some, they hide some, and you see them pushing and shoving. And it's I'm like, yeah, it's far-fetched, but it's not anymore. It's fucking sad. Mm-hmm.
And they, like I said, they try to catch him, but he's too late. But they get the license plate, which they'll use shortly. And Woody wakes up in this, you know, high-rise apartment. And we meet a couple of other characters, Jesse, Bullseye, and Prospector. And it's kind of scary for him because they're all, like, obsessive over him. And we don't know why. So this is always an interesting thing when you look at these sequels, is you have to create new characters. And Jesse could have been the most obnoxious character possible, not just because they got Joan Cusack to do the voice, who I usually don't care for, but she's great in this.
She's going overboard with this huge cowgirl voice, right? And they told her, they're like, no, we want you to use your voice. She's like, but I'm from Chicago. Like, that doesn't come off very well to be this old-style cowgirl if I do my Chicago voice. As she does it, she sounds like a cowboy from Chicago. I think she's good here. She has the character has a really good moment later. I do think she kind of wears thin a little bit though towards the end of the film.
I love Jesse in this, in other things. When I, you know what, god dang it, this is gonna sound creepy, but yep, I got my pictures with that redheaded cowgirl in the theme park.
Yeah, that is creepy, Adam. What are you talking about?
Yeah, shut up. But I think she's fantastic. I do think some of the other choices that they had, I don't know if Jessie would be the fan favorite she is. There's something about the way she speaks. It's almost like when we discussed Incredibles and Holly Hunter, just some of the way she speaks out of the side of her mouth that gives personality to that character. And I get the same thing with Joan Cusack here. I get the embodiment when I'm watching Jessie talk of Joan Cusack doing it. What I really like is I forget, especially throughout it, how many different emotions and moods that we get from Jessie. You know, she's not all, she's happy, then she's sad, then she's mean. It's a tremendous performance.
What I like about her a lot is how genuine she is. Like every single movement she does, every single thing she yells, either in excitement or out of anger, is all a genuine emotion and not just put on. And that I really vibed with.
And there's also a really important distinction that the movie's going to reveal that I think is a brilliant device from a writing standpoint, which we'll talk about. But they're all acting like they just discovered, if Tom Cruise walked into the room, not just because him and Woody are about the same height and proportions to most women, but be that as it may, it also would have been very annoying. You just have a Woody clone that's a girl, especially in an era nowadays where you have a lot of like talk about Mary Sue and female characters that are just carbon copies of other pre-existing male characters, but they distinguish her enough and they get a lot of emotion out of Bullseye, which is impressive for a character that doesn't speak. But this also puts the question, why can't he speak but all the other toys can?
But
they changed it last minute.
Yeah, that was a last minute change. But that's true with all figures, are just little alterations of the main figure, you know? So I kind of
went. Yeah, this is a brilliant addition to the lore of, you know, because you didn't just have the main principal character, you know, it's not just He-Man. You had all the supporting characters. As we'll find out, Woody is part of a gang and he's the star attraction, but you had to have other parts of the set. And the other impressive thing about the voice cast, so we have Kelsey Grammer as the prospector, who's not just doing Sideshow Bob, which he very easily could have been and already was at the time.
I didn't think we'd get Kelsey Grammer till next week. I thought he was next week's villain, but no, we get him here. And man, he is just one of those villains that just kind of comes out of nowhere too. You see him and he comes off as very warm and fuzzy, but he's really not, which I really like.
Well, because the movie gives you no hints that he's capable of being the villain, because we already have Al.
Yeah.
And the first film, you had the human villain, or the misunderstood, although Al's a little bit more malicious because he's a fully grown adult. So you can't really give him that sort of pass that you gave Sid. But they're all like, look, you know, we're happy we finally found you because we've been here for a considerable amount of time. And now that you're here, we're going to be part of a full set. And he realizes that, you know, now they're going to go and be immortal. You know, they're going to live on in a different way. So Woody is now put in an interesting paradigm for a character arc of, in the first film, Woody felt repressed because he wasn't the favorite. He was Andy's like favorite for a long time and he got replaced. And now he's in a perspective where he realizes that he's got his uniqueness back, even though he's not the only Woody toy, but now he feels special again in a whole new context.
What I really like about this conundrum he finds himself in is that everybody here is right. You understand everybody's perspective, and that is good drama. That is very good writing. And Woody is really put in a position here where he is the one that makes this set complete. So while he belongs with Andy, he also belongs to them. And if he were to leave either, both sets of things are devastated. So yeah, I like the conundrum they put him in here.
He literally found his people.
Yeah.
He found his tribe. There's something there. I get so much of it more. This is one of those films, every time I watch it, I'm still getting a little more and more, you know. But depending on which existential crisis as an adult you want to view this through, you're like, yeah, I have meaning again. Or I know that I will continue to have meaning when my kids have grown up and moved away from me. Sorry, this may be hitting a little closer to frickin' home right now.
Oh, wait till next week. Well, I also look at this through the lens of, like, you find out who you thought your parents were, you're adopted, and you get the opportunity to meet your true parents. I think you look at it through that lens. And I also appreciate the movie's about nostalgia because it's a whole 50s Western, you know, howdy doody type of get up with the Woody show. And it's literally, I like that a character named Woody is controlled on TV as a marionette. I think that's a cool way to justify the name, but they go really very in-depth with the merchandising, with the amount of stuff that there is, which was very... We were starting to get into that, the whole collectible, mm-hmm. the thing that The Simpsons made fun of with Comic Book Guy. That was a huge part of, like, pop culture within fandom, or people that would hoard every type of merchandise associated with an IP done in a kid's movie from a property that, even in this movie, is outdated.
Yeah.
But it still has meaning to people. In the case of Al, it's purely profit, but from the perspective of, like, collectors selling them off, it's everybody gets to experience it.
I feel like this part of this is also such a commentary, and they really didn't have this term until much later, but the Diz adults who just swarm and must have everything Disney, and it's just becomes an obsession, but not in a way because you love it, but you can do it to sell it. You're scalpers, you're taking it, but you must be obsessed with a certain part of it. It's very thoughtful that way.
And they realize that the kiss of death for them, they realize he still has an owner. Because he's like, look, I got to get back to Andy. They show him the boot, and that sort of sends them into a downward spiral, because they find out that Woody realizes that if he leaves, they're going to be put in storage, which is like purgatory, I guess, for toys, because they don't have a kid to play with, and they just sit around all day. So I like that Woody is put in a real difficult spot, but there's no wrong answer, but there's also no right one, which is a pretty sophisticated thing to do for a kid's film. But the movie never gets too... I don't think it gets too existential for its own good, which there are, I think, some films that Pixar has made that go a little bit too far into that. I think WALL-E was one that did that for the first three quarters, and then the last quarter became too much of a kid's film. I feel like they shifted the perspective too quickly. But the movie's also not devoid of humor, because we cut to them trying to find the commercial, and Ham goes, oh, you're going too slow. And he starts, which we all had to do back in the day. You had to click through the channels.
Yep.
And if you went past it, and they're like, you went past it. He's like, too late. I already went through. Got to go all the way back to ground zero. They use the Etch-A-Sketch to find the toy barn, which they realize, oh, we have to go there because that makes all the sense in the world that he'd be there. They get a rescue mission, and Potato Head's getting his wife packing up his proverbial suitcase, which any married person knows that feeling.
Wonderful bit of continuation here. You've already mentioned it, Matt, but the fact that there's a Mrs. Potato Head revealed at the end of last week's film, here she is just making sure that Mr. Potato Head's all packed up, ready to go. This is fun stuff. I always like when she's just like, oh, there's your angry eyes. You're gonna need them.
And as we find out, the scene was technically even longer at one point.
Yeah.
What's great about it is if you're a kid, it's just funny because this is what you did with your Potato Head. If you're the parent taking your kid, or even just, you know, a little older going to it, it's your life. You know, so mm-hmm. this is, oh, it's so good.
Yep. And there's the whole, we got to go save the captive prisoner, or so we think, because they think Woody's being held hostage, which he technically is, but it's his fellow captors, if you want to look at it, that they're not as antagonistic as Al is. So, you know, we cut back to Woody. He's getting more enamored with, like, his history. They're showing him clips from the show. I also appreciate Pixar went the extra length to animate these like, short cliffhangers with marionettes.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm.
they did not have to go to this extent, but you could tell this was really a labor of love, which is equally impressive given this was probably hell for so many people.
I was going to say, labor of love. I mean, labor of getting that shit done. But what's so great about this movie, though, and I will say great in this instance, is if you did not hear that story that we told 30, 40 minutes ago, the making of this movie, you wouldn't feel it. Because there are times when movies are made in these crunch situations where we feel it. You know, we've talked about them a lot on this podcast. Here, this story feels like it was constructed and put out in the 4-year span from the time the last one came out to when this was released. And that's a big compliment.
And he realizes that the show was canceled. And this is also an interesting bit of connective tissue. We find out that the prospector is also prejudiced against space toys.
Mm-hmm.
Because he mentioned Sputnik.
Yep.
He's like, children mm-hmm. only wanted to play with space toys, which it's crazy that it's kind of like Woody's, you realize now, because like you have to understand, if you're a writer, you have to build to, why would Woody choose these people over Andy? Because he sees literally so much of himself in them, not just because he's a part of their story, but because he literally says, I know how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
And another great thing they mention, and this goes over a kid's head, they specifically mention he's never been outside of his box.
Yep.
So you have no reason to believe that he's, like, part of the pun pulling the strings.
This is where I think they would have been a little too far ahead of part of the original, and I think it went through iterations, but the original conceit was going to be collectibles versus toys that are played with. And I think that's a really good idea. I just don't think it's right for the second one, and especially 99. I think it plays so much better today. And you could see some of that there. And I'm glad they left in that part of it, because for those that know, it's fantastic. And they do little things, you know, to hint at it. And there's little parts of it that for the collectible community, it's really, really smartly done. But it's also, it doesn't tip the hand that he's evil, though. Woody has a choice to make. We have our bad guy. We have our stakes. That's it. It's as simple as could be. And I think it's an amazing piece of cinema that they decide to break the rules for this kind of film and go where they do.
And it's also like he's not purposefully being manipulative, because he doesn't have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it also would have been really easy to have Jesse and Bullseye be in on it as well.
Yeah.
But I like that they keep it just to him when we actually get that reveal. Because I also think that would have been, given what we'll learn about Jesse, that would not have tracked, like if it was a big conspiracy. Because it makes you wonder, they would have had to plan this for, like, in case we ever got a Woody, we all have to agree that we keep him here no matter what.
Yeah.
So that would have been a huge, like, thing to have to constantly talk about. But speaking of things to talk about, we get the scene I assume Garrett hates more than anything, of the toys having to cross the street. You know, this is the game of Frogger in real life. They have to get in the traffic cones, and they're saying drop, and I'm sure they killed more people in this movie than Superman did in Man of Steel.
I hate this. I get it. And look, I mean, if you're a kid, you don't think about it, but putting them in these cones and have them cross the street while these cars are going everywhere, it's an exciting scene if I were 5 years old, but I'm not. I'm an adult, and I'm just thinking about the logic of it. It doesn't make any sense. It's cute from a kid perspective, but from an adult perspective, I hate it.
I have fun with this. I still do. I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm not even going to say you're wrong, and it's fun to me, especially because I know the street that this is modeled after. Because it's right down the street from freaking Pixar. I have so much fun with this.
I have fun with it because of there is a certain amount of creativity, and they build in suspense with his shoe getting stuck and you're worried he's going to get run over. They do the thing of the 18 wheelers, like tank comes off and starts rolling towards them. And I also like that they cut to the giant traffic jam that they've caused. Like it's not.
Yes. You see the result.
Like, it's not just, oh, we're not going to give this any thought. We're just going to act like nothing happened. No, you see, there are repercussions. I'm sure the insurance companies would have had a field day watching this movie. I can picture an Allstate agent having an aneurysm watching this, or the worst case of PTSD. But they managed to get into Al's toy barn, and I like the sense of scale. It's like, this is the toy mecca, and you see all the different aisles. They got the strategy. He's reading the strategy guide, and all right, well, we also get this. After being cast aside, Barbie makes her debut.
Yes.
And this is also funny because the Barbies fully realize they are part of a set. They say, I'm tour guide Barbie. It's like the specialty types which they had. Mm-hmm. And you got Potato Head saying, I'm a married man.
And you know what? In the last 3 years, we've had this character be personified on screen, right? But before 1999, I would not have known how Barbie would sound. But in watching this, you know right away, like, oh yeah, that's how she definitely would sound. Adam, wasn't there like a controversy with Barbie around this time? Remember when they did the talking Barbie? And when you pulled the string, it said, math is hard.
Yes, that's right.
So,
I'm sorry, I didn't know what you were talking about. Yeah, I do.
That was huge, man. I remember that vividly. That kind of Barbie is, look, it's not very PC, shall we say. Girls who have these toys, they would want to grow up to look like this. You would not want that for your daughter. But at the same time, my sister played with Barbie. My mom played with Barbie. I'm glad to see that Mattel was like, you know what? Fuck it. We see that there's money to be made. We're going to put her here. And guess what? They use her a lot in this. Like, we're going to have a full-out Barbie party. I like seeing Barbie here.
Yeah, it's not just a one-off appearance.
Yeah, exactly. And remember, like, they had written her to be the one who rescues Woody last time, and she's not that here. They actually have her be, like, the party Barbie here.
Right, and they're going through all the different aisles. She's literally giving them a tour, and he's like, which way do we go? She's like, oh, that has to wait till the end of the tour. And
Rex loses the strategy guide. He runs after the car. You get the Jurassic Park reference, which always makes me laugh.
I love that. I love that shot. I forgot about that shot. Good.
So good.
Because if you know it, it's everything. If you don't know what that's referencing, which you have to be living under a rock to not catch that, it's just, you know, them looking and seeing them running at him. But, you know, like I said, the strategy guide gets knocked over, and they intercut that Woody's literally across the street. Al lives right across the street, so they're kind of doing this for nothing. Woody gets his equivalent of going to the chiropractor, because he gets stitched up, he gets repainted, and it's the guy from the Pixar short that played before A Bug's Life, where he's playing chess with himself.
Oh, that's funny.
Yes.
Now,
yep.
Are there people who repair toys?
Yes, okay. There are.
Okay.
Yeah, especially vintage ones like this. Yeah, because matching the stitching, doing the same style of stitch, painting and doing some of that is when you have to start listing them as altered. But shoot, I'll go one better. They have comic book pressing to clean up comics before getting them graded and stuff. I guess that's the only thing that this doesn't do, is it doesn't go into the grading of toys, because that would, you know, come a little bit later with popularity. But yeah, there sure is. But this creates an issue for me in the later films. They make a big deal about it in trailers we've seen later on. Woody's getting old here. Mm-hmm. Woody's got a bald spot. That's a joke in a later trailer. Woody's already hurt. He's aging out. But here, it is such a brilliant thing to think of, especially as a kid. My toys are old, and they want to keep living. Well, guess what? I wake up with a bad back every morning, too.
Yeah, tell me about it. I say that as the youngest person on here by a considerable margin, so I'm just going to...
Yeah, thanks, Buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, speaking of Buzz, we get the reveal that there is literally a wall of Buzz Lightyears.
This is such a shot at the first movie.
Matt, am I the only one who thought of Child's Play 2 when they get to this aisle?
Yeah, and I love how we get another Buzz that is recreating the Buzz we saw in the first film.
Yes.
Because he thinks he's the Space Ranger. So it's like, clearly there is a defect in these toys that leads them to think they're not a toy.
And I love it. And the animators were very, I think it was Lasseter, actually, who said that, you know what, Buzz, since he's been integrated with the rest of the group, and, you know, everybody's buddy-buddy with one another, they didn't really have a conflict for Buzz. They didn't really know what to do with them. What you do is you just do exactly what you did last time, which was the best part of the Buzz character, which is give him the same existential crisis, except do it from another toy of the same name. This is great. Like, I love when Buzz is tied up in the box and they don't even realize that it's a different Buzz when he comes in. This is fun stuff.
Yeah, and he's the new model because he's got a utility belt, which he doesn't have. Mm-hmm. He says, like, am I really that fat? As he's looking at him, he gets tied up, and the other Buzz, utility belt Buzz, thinks that all the other Buzzes are in cryo sleep. So, like, they're putting a lot of thought into, like, how in his own head these Space Rangers are, and he never questions why they all look like me. Because right after this, we'll get the TV show, the animated TV show that they did, which is basically the video game played out. Now, it's not Tim Allen, it's Patrick Warburton.
Yeah,
it's the cadence is certainly still there.
Yeah, I forgot about that cartoon.
A lot of people did. It ran for a little while, but it wasn't, because like when Lightyear came out, people were like, "Oh, how have they never done this before?" And then you have the people who go, well, actually, those assholes always exist. But he joins the group and nobody questions it, even though he's calling them like Slotted Pig. And he doesn't even know their names, which nobody even questions. But I also find that amusing. Like, they even call out the belt.
Yeah.
Like, once you get that, he just says, like, there's standard issue. And, you know, we cut back to Woody again. He's feeling great, but not before the toys leave. And they knock over a Zurg figure, which... Great design, like I said. I love the Zurg vision thing they use, because that's what these toys would have.
Absolutely. And
like the little thing that you look through and it's all red.
Yeah, and I love how he gets unboxed, you know? Like, he just falls and he gets unboxed. That was good.
Well, they also put a lot of thought into like the physics. Like, all the toys have to jump to activate the weighted doors.
Yep.
Like, again, like a lot of the detail, like, you know, Garrett bitched about the flaws in having these toys use traffic cones, but at the same time, you have a movie where they're thinking about how the technology would interact with the real world.
Yeah, just that they're not heavy enough to open the door. That's a little thing that doesn't matter. It makes this animated movie about talking toys feel real.
Oh, yeah. My problem with the cones doesn't advance to this store. Like, once they're in the store, I'm having a great time. It was just getting here that was a kind of a drag for me.
And you had the whole thing of Woody's trying to, you know, create some conflict where Woody's thinks he's being sabotaged because he tries to turn off the TV. And then, you know, he thinks Jesse did it. So they're at odds. And we find out, you know, you talk about the real world. This is where we get the Jesse backstory. Because Woody says, like, how do you know how I feel about Andy? And she says, I had Emily. And the smartest thing they did in this movie was make sure Randy Newman did not sing this song.
You know what I realized in watching this movie is I love Randy Newman's music when he's not singing. I think the Randy Newman music here is great because he's not singing it.
And this is the scene that made grown men cry when they showed this movie, actors included.
And you have Sarah fucking McLachlan here. She's like associated with all those goddamn ASPCA commercials. My God. Fuck. Every time I heard that bitch's voice, I would just turn away because I knew that those goddamn dogs were on the screen. She is the perfect one to put here. I do find... Okay, here we go. And this is going to probably cause a fight. But I do find what Jesse is angry at to be a little childish in that... Why is she mad? Because the girl grew up? What did she expect would happen?
I think it's that she didn't come to terms with it the way that Woody did. Because people process trauma in different ways. And I say people, but these are toys. If I'm reading this, it's not so much that she got replaced, it's that she got dumped. She wasn't kept after a certain point and that's the only life she's known. And now with this Roundup gang that she's with, she's like, oh, I'm not going back to that life because I know how it ends.
But Woody, he's not handling it any better. By the end of this, he is. But
yeah, but at this point, he's already accepted that that's part of, to a certain degree, like he's accepted that Andy's going to grow up.
Yeah,
and he's still not 100% ready with it.
I just don't understand why she's so upset that the chick is older now and she's just like, yeah, I don't need you anymore. Now, the fact that she is underneath this bed for that long is the sad part of it. That was the part that really got me. But other than that, I don't think this resonated with me like they wanted it to.
Yeah, I see this as somebody who gave her everything to make her child happy. And at the end of the day, that child forgot about her and abandoned her. And that's it. She was left without purpose. This would have been Woody. If Woody was replaced... Who's to say Woody wouldn't be just as angry? But he wasn't. It ended out differently for him. This is the island of misfit toys. You know, this is a Charlie in the box. I think it's interesting because it's no fault of Emily's, but this is Jesse processing the trauma by being literally given away, left in a box to be donated.
Yeah, and she's still on the anger phase of the stages of grief.
Yeah, this is the, you know, it made grown men cry in 1999, and in 2026, it pretty much has the same effect. I love that Randy Newman tried to fight to still sing this song, and everybody else heard Sarah McLachlan and went, no, not going to do it. Not going to change it.
It would not have worked at all, because you have that disconnect is, I know it's not Jesse. Yep. I know it's not Joan Cusack, but I still feel like it's coming from her. This would have felt really artificial if it was Randy Newman singing the song.
Yeah, I like the score that he does of this. It doesn't overtake it like it does in the first one, but this song is such an emotional beat. Like, it still, I mean, it chilled me up. My eyes welled.
And if that wasn't bad enough, this is where Prospector, he's such a good manipulator, he steps in to be like, oh, she opened the door, I'm going to kick it down like the Kool-Aid man, because he's saying, like, look, Andy's growing up and there's nothing you can do about it. And he's telling him, you can go back, like, I'm not going to stop you, but... you can stay with us and last forever. And that's kind of the moment where Woody, to a large part, comes to terms with his mortality.
Yeah, he's like, do you really think he's going to take you to his high school graduation? Do you really think he's going to take you to his new college? He's given him all the scenarios. And again, like I mentioned earlier, this is good drama because you see everybody's point of view here, and it works drama-wise. So good writing on everyone's part here.
And he's right.
Yeah.
Like, Stinky Pete is absolutely correct.
Well, yeah, Stinky Pete is also talking from a perspective of hasn't been wanted by anybody.
Yeah, he's never been played with. He doesn't have that perspective.
Yeah.
But he only matters as part of the set.
I know. He's fucking Stinky, for Christ's sake. You know, like, nobody wants a fucking toy.
That's also brilliant that you took the character who was basically comic relief on the show and made him the villain. I think that's very smart, too, because you don't suspect that. And speaking of expectations, the rescue party comes to the apartment. They have to. I like that they treat scale in this as well as they did in the first one, because they have to scale the elevator And it's this massive, like, how we look at spelunking and cave diving is just them trying to go up the elevator.
And again, it's Buzz is here, but he's not here. This is all fun. Yeah,
he thinks they're magnetized when they fall up the elevator. It's so good. And then you get the use your head, and they use Rex as a battering ram. And this is where they're all suspecting, like, okay, something's not right about Buzz, because they're all a little... Now they're starting to get a little concerned. But not before the real Buzz comes, but Utility Belt Buzz goes full commando and, like, wrestles Jesse into submission. He's treating it like an actual rescue mission, like, shoot to kill and ask questions later. But the real Buzz shows up, and it's the great cliche of, how do you know which one's the real one? He lifts up his foot, you see the AME mark, and that's how they know.
And then he hits the helmet, and New Buzz that's how he beats the same reaction.
Again, I love how they're all programmed the same way.
Yep. I mean, I think they're telling us that, and I think it's a commentary, especially back in the 90s, Buzz came from China, and it was different than toys made here. I think that's part of the joke they're making, especially back then.
I think that's true as well, and I also appreciate the movie here. If you were a betting man, like, as a kid, you think, oh, Woody's going to go back with them, but he tells them, no, I'm staying.
Mm-hmm.
And Buzz is not quite sure how to deal with that.
Oh my God. And once again, they play off those slinky dog eyes, man. We never mentioned that Andy's dog actually gets a kind of a good scene. Earlier, we see that dog just kind of tackle, I believe that was Buzz, wasn't it? Or was it Woody that he tackles earlier in the film? And my family has had Dachshunds our entire lives, and this is how they are. But Slinky Dog is a toy personification of that, and he's the last one to go in that vent, and the look he gives Woody, oh my God, this had the effect on me that Sarah McLachlan song had on you guys.
They don't force him. They don't spend much time trying to change his mind. Like, it's not a massive conflict. This could be everything, but it's not. I mean, they're all trying to understand each other, and nobody's wrong here. It's much more thoughtful than just Woody's wrong because he's going to go be in a museum. He's right. The other toys are right. Everybody's right for their own reasons.
Yeah, and Woody still has in his headspace that, you know, Andy's moved on from me. Like, he's come to terms with that. Now, there is the thing of, like, oh, your mom is the one who grabbed you, so it's not 100% Andy's doing. But he's had his eyes opened up that Prospector's right, that I'm not going to have that forever aspect, but I can have it in a museum where I'm not having the literal playtime, but I live forever, at least until they stop caring.
And he knows Buzz is a good toy for Andy, and he know Buzz is going to take care of Andy, and vice versa.
And they don't pick him up and drag him back. They willingly leave, but Woody has the compromise in his head of, like, you know, come with me, where it's not, I can't leave them behind necessarily, but I can have them with Andy, and we're all still together. Jesse's on board, Bullseye's on board, and he turns around the box, and we see he's out of there, and he's a plastic pickaxe can weld a latch shut, apparently, but, you know, this is the heel turn, and it's totally earned. And for something that, in a large aspect, you should see coming, I think this is, in a lot of ways, this is one of the best twists of, like, Syndrome, this is one of the best ones they've done.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I tried, but you've maybe forced my hand, and they're all shocked that he's out of the box. And this is where we kind of get fun, evil Kelsey Grammer, where he's like, look, we have an eternity to spend together. We're not going to start pointing fingers now. And he says, like, you know, I'm not going to let some hand-me-down cowboy mess up my plans. And this, you know, this is where his true color, they call him Sticky Pete for a reason, his true colors come out, and he... Basically, if it wasn't for Al walking in, he probably would have stabbed them with the pickaxe to force them to go. Mm-hmm. But they have to play dead, and they get put in boxes. Al's got a flight to catch to Japan, and the toys realize, oh, we're going to go rescue him, but Zurg shows up.
Throughout everybody's plans.
Yeah, you know, he's the third man.
Yeah,
showing up to screw everything up. But I love, okay, how does this toy have this many ping pong balls?
Unbelievable. Yeah, I thought of that too.
That's my one thought. I'm like, this would be a nightmare for parents. You know, this is how they wind up behind the couch, underneath the kitchen. And we get in an era where we are so sick of Star Wars jokes, I still laugh at the "I am your father" pull.
I do too. You know why? Because they don't make it like a one-off joke. They keep it going. That's why I like it. And yeah, you're right. Like nowadays, like, oh, Star Wars, oh, not again. And don't forget, Phantom Menace was just a set of months before this. So Star Wars was still on people's minds. And yeah, this was a fun joke. And, you know, you mentioned the how many ping pong balls this were. I thought this might have been the Cheez-Its that were on the ground from earlier in the movie. Because, God, that was a lot of Cheez-Its. And nothing to find slob like fucking Cheez-Its. and all the dust. Cheetos, yeah. All the Cheetos that are on his hands as he's fucking, oh, God, so disgusting.
Don't touch your toys. Stay away from my toys with your freaking Cheeto dust.
Yeah, or Doritos. Anything that leaves the powder.
Cheez-Its is fine. I can grab them by the corners, and they work good with chopsticks.
And this joke is extra, it's magnified because not only did they do the "I am your father," they go the extra mile in doing the dramatic no.
Yeah, that was great.
As the elevator falls, which makes it even funnier. Mm-hmm. And they realize that, you know, Woody's going to get on a plane. And again, talk about setups and payoffs. We get a Pizza Planet truck.
Yep, every Pixar movie.
Is it?
Yep.
That's what they use.
Oh, interesting. Yep.
They have the Pizza Planet truck in every one, and every movie has a nod to their next film in it.
And they tell the other Buzz, you're gonna come with us? He's like, no, I'm going to play catch with my dad. Which also makes you laugh.
Yes, same here. All the Buzz stuff in this is great.
Yeah, it's amazing they get so much mileage out of recycling the same material.
Yep.
But they make it work. And I also love how the toys have to use everybody to try to drive. Yeah, because you got some work at the pedals, you got one steering, the freaking... You have him just reading the mechanic guide, not even helping. He's just reading the accessories and shit. Just makes me laugh. And, you know, the climax for this movie, what I like, they went bigger. And they're putting their technological advancements forward because they go inside the room where all the luggage is being sorted and it's massive. You know, they're having to jump and look through all the different suitcases.
Did they do a Toy Story 2 video game?
Yes, they did. It was a platformer.
Did they have a level like at this airport?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
I had the game for N64. This was one of the last levels.
Oh, like, I imagine it was pretty hard.
I remember beating it, but it took me a while. But I'm pretty sure there was a level. There were multiple levels at the airport.
And guys, I couldn't help but think, we just did an airplane scene where they're chasing down an airplane. It was the Incredible Hulk. Remember the Death of the Incredible Hulk? We have another one here.
You know, this is two movies in a row where you had a little RC car catch up to an actual car, and Bullseye is fast enough to catch up to an airplane.
Yeah.
Hey, he runs like the wind, Bullseye.
Ugh. That's true.
It popped me that this is Oakland Airport. Yeah. I know this airport because this is the one I fly in and out of.
Yeah, this is another scene, though. It's just ridiculous. Like, the whole climax is just ridiculous. You go with it because it's toys and we love these characters, yada, yada. But the fact that they get through this and they're going to end up driving the luggage cart home even Andy goes up and is like, "Mom, thank you for getting me all these toys." Like, the mom wouldn't say, "Oh, I didn't get all the," like, it's so silly, but you go with it because you're having a good time.
I will say it is so silly that I could name probably five movies that have copied this, from the luggage to the chase on the tarmac to jumping out of the wheel of a plane. Like, I've seen action movies copy this sequence.
Well, they copied Die Hard 2, let's be fair.
Yeah, well, except they did it better. And I love how they, instead of just throwing Prospector into like an incinerator or letting him get sucked into a jet engine like the Incredibles, like, these toys are vindictive. They send him to put him in like a girl's backpack. She gets taken home, which for him is like hell, basically.
Yeah.
So I like that these toys are petty as fuck.
Well, shoot, he could still come back. He could come back.
You know, this is like the opposite of early Marvel movies, where the Marvel movies always killed off their villains. Like, Sid and Prospector are still kept around. And they all decide to, you know, they go home, and at Garrett's point, they use the freaking luggage cart to drive home. And, you know, Woody gets repaired. And we see Al just miserable because he lost his toy deal on the television. So I like that there's a payoff for that, because it's the, okay, what does he do now without his collection? He's probably going to, in between 2 and 3, probably commit suicide in that apartment.
Yeah.
What I appreciated is Andy sewed up Woody.
Yes.
So Al took the time to get Jerry's his name, to have Jerry come in and sew up Woody to make him so perfect, and his arm rips again. Andy does it, and if you look, his arm is a little bit bigger than his other one, so he either stuffed it bigger or used something. So Andy made him stick around, and he's not perfect, but he's going to last.
I do love when Andy
still cares about him.
Yeah. Yep. I do love when Andy's done with him. Woody even has like this bout of confidence because he's like his arm's bigger now. So that was a nice little touch.
Bo Peep looking good, cowboy.
Oh, I'd forgotten about Bo Peep.
Yeah, because she stays behind.
Yep.
Because they got Barbie this time.
Oh, yeah. So does this franchise.
Yeah.
We get the fourth one.
Ugh, disrespect.
Like, they treat her like Rose in the next movie.
And I do like that Jesse's here. Woody was able to come in. But here's the thing that's fun, that's kind of stupid about this. Why wouldn't he use the line, but he has a little sister, when he was trying to convince her earlier? Like,
well, she went away with it the first. He didn't have to resort to that.
Oh, my God. It was just...
Disney realizes that they're going to sell toys to girls as well with this one.
And I don't remember if she gets any storylines in the future movies. I'll be looking forward to seeing that. But I do like that she's finally integrated with the rest of the toys.
Yeah.
And this movie, I love the way that it's done. She's part of the gang. When she gets a skateboard and jumps to the door the same way that she falls without style, and they literally give Buzz a freaking erection by having his wings.
Oh, Jen was in the room when that scene came up, and like I actually rewound it, and I looked at Jen after, and I showed her. I'm like, Jen, this is supposed to show an erection, right? And she's like, oh yeah, that's what that is.
That's a DreamWorks joke that Disney would not allow today.
Yeah, it's the only time where it almost feels like Shrek, that kind of joke, but it works for this movie. And perfect, of course, though, I had to use it as my blooper reel as well, my blooper stinger.
Yeah, I mean, they get mileage out of it because they use it in the outtakes, which we'll talk about shortly. But that's exactly what that is. And the movie ends in a way that I normally hate with a big dance number. But it's because Wheezy suddenly gets Robert Goulet's voice.
So stupid.
Which made me laugh because I can't not think of Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I guess.
But I like that it's like, okay, I know Andy's going to age, so we're just going to enjoy the time we have left.
This... I really like the last lines of this movie, because it could end on a somber note, but no, it is a note of acceptance. Woody just looks at Buzz and is like, yep, Andy's going to grow up, and when that happens, we'll deal with it, but let's enjoy this while it lasts. That was a really nice way to end this film.
And it ends with, you know, them celebrating because they rescued Woody and they're thinking about the future, but we get Pixar's the second film in a row where they do outtakes to kind of close out the film, like they're shooting an actual movie. And there's the one that's controversial, though.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, because they removed it.
Yep.
If you're streaming this on
Disney Plus.
No.
Okay, so one of the outtakes is Prospector talking to two Barbie dolls saying, I'm sure I could get you a part in Toy Story 3.
Oh, shit. No, I didn't know about that.
Which,
and it's Kelsey Grammer like giving the slimiest of performances to say
in a John Lasseter film. Yeah,
between that and the Me Too movement, Disney took that shit out quick. You know, they pulled a Song of the South and locked that in the vault.
This is where I got my idea to do bloopers at the end of our podcast was these Toy Story bloopers, which I always get a kick out of. They made me laugh.
And I also laughed they killed the two characters from A Bug's Life.
Yeah, that was funny.
And one such of them. A great joke. We're here. They actually brought Heimlich and Flick back to make a joke about we're not getting a freaking Bug's Life 2.
Which they never have.
No, they haven't.
Yeah, we got three Cars movies, but they never went back to that well.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that does it for Toy Story. Yeah. Look.
It's fine. Leave the best one you've had alone.
Yeah. And I say that someone doesn't really like A Bug's Life, but I certainly am much more positive on this movie. Although, how far am I going to go? How high am I going to go? Well, that remains to be seen. I'm going to go to Garrett first. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Toy Story Part 2?
Oh, you bastard. All right.
I've been called worse by you.
Toy Story 2. Coming in, I knew that I was going to probably be the stickler of this podcast, the one who is not looking back as fondly on this as a lot of people do. And watching it for this podcast, I did have a really good time watching it. I laughed a lot this week, maybe not as much as last week, but I had a good time with this. I do also like that it's a story about acceptance. And what I really respect about Pixar and the way they present their films is they present adult situations in a kid's movie. These are situations that, look, Bambi killed Bambi's mom in the course of that movie, and Bambi had to deal with that. Yes, that is grief that you have to deal with. But Pixar takes themes and they put them into a kid's movie, and a kid actually can watch it and really resonate with it, as well as adults. Also, just looking back at this and looking at Al, yeah, he's a slob, and of course he's going to be the villain of the movie. They don't take that as far as I remembered it going. He's an antagonist just to get Woody with the real antagonist of this film, which is, of course, Stinky Pete. I am not as high on the Jessie storyline as a lot of people are. I think it's fine. I think it's good that she's integrated with the rest of the crowd, but at the same time, I'm glad that she's integrated with the rest of the crowd. I just didn't resonate with her story as much as most people did. Still, I had a pretty good time with this. Of course, the cones on the street, don't even get me back started on that. The buzz stuff is what really sells this for me, and that's what's going to make it not as high as last week. I'm going to go 7.5, just a half point lower, but it is lower than last week. However, I still had a hell of a good time with Toy Story 2. It's a healthy, healthy 7.5 out of 10.
All right, we got the dreaded 0.5 bullshit that we just get shit for at the old place. Adam, what about you?
I struggle a lot with what film do I love most, especially in early Pixar, between Toy Story, Bug's Life, Toy Story 2. When I rewatched this one, I think it does the thing that so many movies have a hard time doing. It assumes you remember what came before because it doesn't spend time going through it. But you know what? If you've never watched the first one, I don't think it matters. There's enough here that you understand what's going on right off the bat. You'll get a little more emotional from the if you know the first one really well, but this is a self-contained sequel, and that's pretty astounding. The additions that they make and that they bring on board are stupendous. Bullseye being a full-fledged character that doesn't speak is great. He's classic Disney sidekick. The revelation of this is Joan Cusack. Her Jessie and the character of Jessie is amazing. Changing the perspective from Woody to Buzz to Woody works. And I was talking to my son after this, and he remembered having his Buzz toy. He remembered loving his Buzz toy. He didn't remember having a Woody, but he remembered having Buzz. He remembered having Jessie. He remembered having Bullseye. He remembered having Rex. So I do think there's something almost instinctual about Woody being us watching our toys not matter anymore, watching our families grow up, and watching life change. Gosh, everything. Even John Ratzenberger playing Ham, he's Cliff. Like, his delivery, his lines, he might as well be sitting at the end of that bar or walking in with his postman uniform. So they know what they're doing. This thing is written brilliantly. It is voice acted even better. There's two or three moments that I'm like, yeah, you could clip out 90 seconds here or there, but that's about it. This is a brisk 90 minutes that tells an emotional story about life, about loss, and about finding who you are. And it does that with toys, something that we can all relate to. I can't give this a 10, but it is the strongest of nines. And I think it is a better film than even the first one, which is a great one. So 9 on 10, the strongest of nines for Toy Story 2.
Adam, whose room did your son's Toy Story toys spend the most time in, his or yours?
His, because, look, they're not going to mix with my collectibles, okay? I can at least understand Al's motivation
here. Fair enough.
Well, speaking of motivation, this leads me to my overall assessment is that I think Adam stole a lot of my thunder. But the thing I'll add is that, you know, we talk about sequels doing bigger and better being sort of the defining aspect of what makes a great sequel. For me, it's a real rarity in that I can't think of the first one now without thinking of stuff from this film and how it really is a continuation as much as it is a sequel, you know, because it reinforces a lot of the ideas, even retreads, but shows you can do that and still make it work with literally recycling Buzz's arc through the lens of another Buzz. But as I mentioned, it does the thing that all sequels should do, is that you are as much of a piece of a larger puzzle as you are just another chapter. Because this goes together as well as it does, to the point you could watch one and two back to back and look at it almost as one holistic piece. And it was for a long time. I mean, we went 11 years before we got a third one, which is when this became sort of a trilogy, you know, an official trilogy by definition. It leads me to wonder, like, is this, I think it's hard pressed for me to find a better Pixar film than this. To me, I still think this is their crowning achievement, because it should not have worked given what this thing went through. Literally, the movie has no right to be as good as this is, given the turmoil, with a capital T, that this thing went through. It is Shawshank. They crawled through a river of shit and got out the other side. And I think this is in my top, it's definitely in my top 100. I don't know where it lands. It's probably on the higher end of 50 than the lower end. And as much as I want to give it a 10, I just fully can't, because I think the whole thing that kicks this off is a little convenient. But this is, to Adam's point, this is as high of a 9 as I can possibly give, to the point where I should have Cheech and Chong sitting next to my score. I just can't quite go a 10, but this is as close to perfect as you can possibly get in a medium where perfection is antiquated and nigh impossible. So it's a very, very strong 9 on the cusp of being a 10. And 10 is how long we had to wait. Actually, over 10 is the amount of years we had to wait for a third film. And I honestly never thought we'd get another one.
I don't think anybody did.
I didn't either.
But when they announced Toy Story 3, because it was a big announcement, because it came right after the purchase and the, I don't know if you want to call it the merger. Adam, when you heard Toy Story 3, were you concerned at all?
Yeah, because it was putting Disney's name first. But on the other hand, I felt that Pixar had not let me down yet. So I was ready. I didn't need it, but when it looked like everybody was back together that had worked on the other ones. I know it moved on director-wise from Lasseter, but he was still part of it. He was still writing it. I think he was still the producer on it, or at least the exec. Stanton was writing it. I was still ready to go. Yeah. It was about the first time I was excited for a threequel.
All right, Mr. Cynic, Garrett. When you heard number 3, were you expected to see dollar signs used in the marketing title?
You know what? This went way past my radar. I did not see this until it hit DVD. I think I mentioned that last week. So I didn't really know, honestly. I do remember thinking, well, that's weird that they're coming out with this 10, 11 years later. You know, I found that to be odd. But I'm not going to say I was excited for it. But I will say this. I remember this being my favorite of the set of Toy Story films. So I'll be interested to revisit it and see if that still holds true. But to answer your question, I was just kind of indifferent when it was coming out. Waited for DVD because, you know, I didn't have a brother to take to it anymore. My brother was around, but he was older at that point. He didn't want to see it, and I wasn't with somebody who would go see a Toy Story movie with me. So I just kind of waited for DVD, and yeah, it ended up being my favorite of the set at that time.
There was something they had put out before this movie, not from Toy Story, from Pixar, that had reinvigorated my love of Pixar, and that's WALL-E. I think without WALL-E doing to me what that movie does, I wouldn't have been as anticipatory.
Haven't seen that.
Up is one thing people go to, but I think WALL-E is the one that kept my love.
I'll give you 3/4 of WALL-E, and then I think the movie kind of loses its way, which I also feel the same way about Up.
Feel that way about Up. Yep.
So I didn't care when they announced Toy Story 3. I was 16. Mm-hmm. I had other things going on in my life. And then I realized, oh, Andy's my age going off to college as I'm a senior in high school. And when I put it into that term, I kind of had a new perspective going in, because I realized, oh, it's, you know, I grew up on these movies and now they're matching the timelines a lot closer than I want them to. But I still couldn't, in my headspace, my angry teenager loner headspace, imagining going to see a Toy Story movie in a theater. But god damn it, I showed up. along with everybody else, because this thing made over a billion dollars.
Billion? This thing crossed a billion?
With a B.
Wow. 1.06 billion.
In 2010.
Yep.
Was it 3D?
Yes.
It was. Okay.
It had it available.
Yeah, it wasn't the sole way you could watch it, but it was, you know, Toy Story 3D. It kind of made sense to play because it was post-Avatar.
Yeah, mm-hmm. 2 years after Avatar. Yep.
You know, and this is a movie, much like the second one, that went through a lot of production changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which we'll talk about. And, you know, Toy Story 2 didn't get a Best Picture nomination. This one sure as hell did.
Yep.
And 15 years later, which movie's more remembered, this or The King's Speech? I'll leave it at that. You want to know why the Oscars are bullshit? It's because of stuff like that.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
And somewhere David Fincher's going, I made The Social Network, and they didn't pick that either. So. Until next week, when we review Toy Story 3, it's your choice, Woody. You can go back, or you can podcast with us and last forever.
I'm going to have some words with this lily pad and let her know how things are run around here.
Try to stay calm, Jesse.
Buzz, you know me. I'm the definition of calm.
That's not going to work.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Good job, troops.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Let's go home.
I'm glad I got to see you again.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as Star Wars, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, Indiana Jones, Masters of the Universe, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Incredibles films, and so much more.
I don't believe that man's ever been to medical school.
Listening. I'm always listening.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Ah, that went well.
It's good to see them fighting again.
It sure is.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You have saved our lives. We are eternally grateful.
Come on, I'm not lying down on the job.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, and Dave.
You would not believe what I've been through tonight.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You got a lot to look forward to, folks.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Hero.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Potato Head, Mr. and Mrs. Here. Trickus, check, 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 check.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
You still worried?
About Andy? Nah. It'll be fun while it lasts.
I'm proud of you, cowboy.
Besides, when it all ends, I'll have old Buzz Lightyear to keep me company. For infinity and and beyond.
Let's see. There's the recorder. You watching the Canon documentary? Mm-hmm. You just heard Over the Top.
Yeah, it's a reel that just showed up. Did you know that for Over the Top?
I'm never reviewing that movie. I'll put that out right now.
You're never what?
I'm never reviewing that, so don't even ask.
Why?
About...
Why would you not review that? Movie's an institution, damn it.
Yeah, it belongs in prison.
Right after Toy Story, people were asking, are you going to do Toy Story 2? He's like, nope, I'm doing this other one first. And then that came out and was also a success.
It was a success, but it's certainly... Oh, go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
I'm going to say, yeah, and with DreamWorks.
But time to get into the movie. All right, so we open with, sorry everyone, I'm running on 2 hours of sleep, I'm very tired. So we open with, oh, it's kind of self-inflicted, I couldn't sleep, I had no clue why, because I'm old. So the movie opens, you get Ace. I was like, am I really that fat, as he's looking at him. You know, this and Galaxy Quest came out the same year, so
yeah,
it's never better, like,
too.
Year. Yeah, he's never had a better year.
Mm-hmm.
I will see that one day.
Oh, you never seen that? Oh, it's fun.
No, I've heard it's fantastic.
When we do Star Trek, we will do that as part of the retro, because I think it's important to talk about it. I know it's not officially Star Trek, but it is in so many ways.
It would be a good Patreon edition, actually.
True. Yeah. Or it's the good one to do in between. Like, we'll talk about that. I'd rather talk about Star Trek in certain capacities. But, you know, he gets tied up in... Until next week when we review Toy Story 3, it's your choice, Woody. You can go back, or you can podcast with us and last forever.
Can you say that again, Matt? You kind of trailed off a little bit. Say it one more time.
Until next week when we review Toy Story 3.
Hi, toys!